speak. I'm very excited and honored to be here. So, and I'm actually kind of a little nervous. It's been a while since I've spoke, and so much is amazing things have been happening in my life, and God has been working in so many fantastic ways that I'm not really sure what's going to come out. So I'm just going to apologize right now, and hopefully that those that are new will receive some sort of message of hope, because that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and particularly in this room, I got sober in YPG and have so many great memories. And I look around the audience and I see so many faces, and Annie was my first sponsor, and Morgie just, I think her laugh alone gave me hope my first year, so thank you. But so I was born and raised in Detroit to a family that was, it wasn't normal. It was the opposite of normal. It was kind of like a bad TV show. My biological father was an abusive sociopath, very, very criminal. And my mom was absolutely amazing. And I think her major function was protecting me from just these very inappropriate and abusive adults for my young childhood. So from the time I was really small, I remember just being really afraid and afraid of life and afraid of what was going to happen, especially afraid of men. And so there was just this doom that I had. The first memory that I have was of my dad pulling a gun on my mom's head, and I was hiding behind the couch. And that was really what sums up my childhood and what it was like. Through Alcoholics Anonymous, I found some peace and some resolution, and can really see that he was a really sick man who had a lot of suffering in his own life and didn't have any sort of coping skills, no God, and I can understand that. I don't forget what happened, but I can understand that, and I can have compassion and love, because it's really, really sad and traumatic when somebody's only option is to be violent and abusive. So growing up in Detroit, I mean, it's Detroit. That's why I'm down here. Everything's gray. People are mean. I remember practicing, like really practicing my bitch look in the mirror. I mean, I'm 7 years old, and I'm like, because that's how it was. People were just aggressive, and if you went out into the world, you had to kind of have this walk, and my friends today will say, you walk, and nobody's going to mess with you, and so I'm kind of grateful for that, but, one thing that I think really saved me in my childhood was swimming. And thank you, Justin, for speaking and talking about your love and obsession of basketball. And that's how I was with swimming. I was a gladiator by the age of 10. I had these shoulders that were just huge, humongous. And always smelled like chlorine. I had no eyebrows. My hair was green. But I absolutely loved it, and it was something that I was obsessed with, and I really thought I was going to go to the Olympics and had this dream and train insane amount of time in the pool. But being from Detroit, it was something that really kept me safe. I was in this bubble, and training and swimming and weightlifting didn't really go with the party scene, and so I was protected. I was a nerd. I was a swim nerd. I was just this weird jock that wore blue sparkle cowboy hats, and I was a little special, but and that I found other friends that had traumatic upbringings too, and so we bonded on how crazy our parents were, and you know, listened to Counting Crows and went to songs and, you know, burned incense and wrote poetry, and that was pretty much my high school, and I didn't start drinking until I came down to Tampa for college, and when I came down here, for my recruiting trip was the first time I had ever stepped into a bar, and we went to Ybor. I was really overwhelmed. I took a sip of alcohol, and this might seem a little strange. I didn't like it. Because of, you know, the abuse in my past and just the trauma of I had experienced as a little kid, I wanted to be in control of everything. And that's why I really liked the sport, because I had a schedule and I really wanted to be control over my body. Right, the control, I guess alcoholics can relate to that. But my world just kind of started going like this, and I didn't like it, and it scared me. I remember the next day, I didn't feel well, and I came back from the trip, and I was like, well, you know, I tried it, you know, and drank, but I don't think that's my thing. Couldn't be more than wrong. So when I came down to Tampa, I wanted to reinvent myself. And the swim team actually called themselves a drinking team with a swimming problem. And they were just these amazing experts in drinking. And I found it fascinating. So in the course of, you know, those months when I had come down here, I studied it, and I studied you, and I studied, you know, what you wore and how you drank and how much you drank. And what I realized is when you drank, you liked me more. And I didn't feel so weird, and I felt like I was kind of just a part of. And so I still, my freshman year, I look back at it, and it was almost kind of magical. There were just these people coming from all over the United States and the world. I went to UT. I mean, it had like minarets, and it was beautiful. The beaches were 45 minutes away. We'd hang out at the beach all the time, and I was learning this whole scene and this whole party scene, which I kind of took pride in. So my parents still lived in Detroit. When I went back, I wanted to really kind of, you know, show off what I had learned, and I met up with some of the cool girls from high school, and we went out to this bar. And this was a major event in my life that really, I think we have these events in our life that just shift the course. And this was one of those. And I was drugged with GHB, and I was raped that night. And so, and I say that because it's, you know, being an alcoholic woman, I hear a lot of experiences that are similar to mine. So I don't have any shame about that. It's part of my journey, but it was extremely, extremely traumatic. It was almost like being underwater. I wanted to pinch myself to wake myself up from this living nightmare. And from that moment on, I found my safety, my security, my sense of well-being, support, I found that in alcohol because it numbed me out. I didn't have to think, I didn't have to feel, and I could completely get to that point of oblivion where I didn't have to be present in my own body, because that was a very, very painful place to be. I didn't want to disappoint my mom and make her worry about me. So I stuffed a lot of my pain and a lot of my suffering, and I tried to continue just getting through that summer. And with Alcoholics Anonymous, I've reconnected to some friends that I hurt during my drinking, and some friends that were really scared for me. And one of them is just this amazing girl, Stephanie. And a couple of years ago, I had a conversation with her, and she said, Marilyn, I remember that exact moment when your drinking changed. It was 3 days after you were assaulted, and you just disappeared. We didn't know what happened. We didn't know the details of it. And when you came over, you just beeline for this big box of wine, picked the biggest glass that you could find, and you just guzzled the whole thing, refilled, drank that, and then you told us what happened. And I think that for her to tell me that, she said it with such sadness and such almost fear that she had witnessed that change in my drinking. And she said after that summer, all you wanted to do was just drink. And what I explained to her is that was all I knew how to do. That was pretty much it. Nights had become so incredibly scary. There was just this nightmare that when I drank, I had to drink to go to sleep. I had to drink to be around people. So I came back down to college, and I didn't want to be that girl. I didn't want to be associated with what had happened. My parents put their house on the market and moved down to Cape Coral, and I think it was they were afraid. They were afraid for me and what was going on and how I was dealing and coping, and they just wanted to be close to me. And I'm grateful for that. And I came down to school, and I put on that mask, you know, that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde that we do, and I pretended everything was okay. And I went through the remainder of those 3 years of college really in a haze, just an alcoholic haze. I had to drink every night in order to go to sleep, and I would disguise it into, like, where's the party and being social and going out. But inside, I was just dying. I was so broken, just absolutely broken. And I didn't know that there was anything different. I thought that I would feel that way for the rest of my life. And so I found, you know, booze helped with that. And it wasn't pretty. My drinking, you know, wasn't pretty. There was a lot of just humiliating and, demoralizing things that I did when I was drinking. Very shameful, absolutely shameful. And I could tell you some funny stories, you know, different things that happened, but I scared a lot of people. I scared my parents and my friends and really people that loved me. And at the same time, if you got too close, I would push you away. So I had different pockets of friends that I would hang out with so that I could do and I could drink the way that I want to, and you wouldn't judge me. And there were some people that I hung out with that weren't the best moral fiber and character, but I could drink and I could get in a blackout and I could piss myself and they wouldn't judge me. So I ended up graduating, and I'm really super grateful that I went to the University of Tampa because it's small and I lived on campus and I could go. I think if I went to any other college, my alcoholism would have just not allowed me to graduate. There just wouldn't have been any hope for that. And so I graduated, and it was just like an hour-to-hour basis, planning when I was going to drink next. I mean, I everything really revolved around alcohol. And I thought if I made my outsides really look a certain way, I had this formula, and it seemed like I kept adding to it. So it was like A plus B plus C equals I would be okay. And then it was like I had gone through like the whole alphabet, and I still wasn't okay. And I wasn't really fooling anybody. My friend started calling me Marilyn Monster, because every time I drank, they didn't know when it would happen, and I would just switch, and I would rage, or I would cry, or I would be just unpredictable, and that's something that's something today I try to be present, and especially in their lives. And so I'm going to take some water right now. It just makes my heart so sad to think about all of those incidences and all the times when I was so drunk and relied on other people to keep me safe, and all the times where I drove drunk and put other people's lives at risk. And It's alcoholism is absolutely just it's a horrendous disease, and the things we do when intoxicated and when drunk are totally outside of who I am and the spiritual being that I desperately and have always wanted to be. And I think people, is it hereditary? Is it based on, experiences or, the whole nature and nurture of what alcoholism is? All I know is alcoholism is rampant in my family. My grandparents were bootleggers. And this alcoholism is part of who I am now, today. And it's something that as I work this program and I'm on this journey, I can embrace so many amazing gifts of sobriety and this way of living. It's phenomenal. So my bottom was on March 10th, 2007. I was celebrating my birthday for about a month straight. And it was a tough week. It was an expensive birthday, about $50,000 of damages. I totaled two cars in 3 days. And the second car was coming back from St. Pete Beach. I was in a blackout. I wanted to drive, obviously, because it was a new car. And I flipped it on an overpass going 70 miles an hour right by Tropicana Field. And it's a miracle that I didn't kill myself or this fiancé person I was with at the time or anybody else. And it was interesting because it was Super Bowl the following year. I had community service and I was, paying restitutions to the state and to the government and to the citizens of, and I was doing community service and I was coming back and I got pulled over because apparently my tire was about to fall off and it was wobbling. I don't know. I'm not good with cars and I'm not a good driver, so I thought it was me. But the law enforcement officer that pulled me over was the same law enforcement officer that responded to that accident. And what he did is he did a double take. Is he looked at me and he said, "I was there that night." And I said, "What do you mean you were there?" He's like, "I was there that night. And you are lucky to be alive." And I said, I am so grateful for you. Thank you. I am so sorry for whatever I said to you. And just so you know, I've been sober since." And he said, "Well, just so you know, your tire's about to fall off. You might want to fix that." So he's like, "Drive safe, get home, and get that fixed." But that's just, that's God right there. And that's absolutely amazing. What are the odds of the same police officer, to be my angel twice is pretty amazing. So I came into the program and because when I woke up after that car accident, I was angry with God for keeping me alive. I was just angry. I felt, why am I still here? And my mom was going through chemotherapy, and so my aunt flew down from Chicago. She had 8 months sober and took me to my first meeting and somehow convinced me that going to detox was a good idea. And I wasn't convinced I was an alcoholic. I thought that I was this, very, very sick, very damaged. By that time, I was on 6 or 7 different psych drugs, and so I thought it was, the PTSD and the trauma and all of this, and I didn't put it together that alcoholism was self-perpetuating my suffering. And I went to my first AA meeting at the Red Door, and oh, it was stinky, and I looked around and I was like, "What is this?" But when they read how it works, a part of my soul just kind of opened up and these tears started streaming down my face. I knew at that moment, this is it. This is what I was missing. And I was an alcoholic. Now, did I believe it to my core? Did I want to believe it? That took about 9 months to really fully understand what that meant. But something shifted in that moment and something God was able to give me the insight to understand that there was something going on here, that my drinking wasn't normal. I went into detox, and I kind of thought it was a vacation. And I would call into work when I'm in detox, telling them, oh, I'm just in the hospital, and try to do these different things. It was just craziness. It was a mess. And I continued going to meetings at the Red Door, where I met this woman who had just sparkles in her eyes. Her eyes just kind of sparkled, and she was clean and happy, and she talked about AA and how she was sober, and she was around my age, and I was just like, what are you? Like, you're just this mystical unicorn person, and I don't understand you at all. And so, of course, I asked her to be my sponsor because I just didn't get it, and what she did is she gave me this amazing program as this package with a pretty little bow on it and you know, these steps and what to do next and what meetings to go to and where to eat and what to do on the weekends. And she was so persistent with me, too. It was awesome. I remember I had picked up my 90-day chip, and I don't recommend this, but I didn't get that to change people, places, and things meant change your people, places, and things. And so I still kept hanging out with my group of friends because, I mean, if they had accepted my drinking, they can accept me being sober, right? And so I picked up my 90-day chip, and I went to this place called Biltmore Station. It's a bar. And they toasted to my 90 days with tequila. Like, yay, Marilyn, you're sober! And I'm sitting here, I'm like, oh, yeah, great. So they're doing these shots, and my sponsor calls. She's like, hey, where are you? I'm like, at a bar? She's like, what are you doing there? I'm like, playing darts. And she's like, really? I was like, yeah, I have this, you know, tonic water with a lime because I didn't want anybody else to know I wasn't drinking. And she's like, well, why don't you step outside? So you go, and I step outside, and I'm talking to her, and she's like, well, do you think this is a good idea? And I was like, yeah, probably not. And I walked in there, and something happened in that conversation because I walked in, and I remember going into the bar, and it smelled. I mean, it was stank. And I looked around, and the people were just all busted up. And I was like, they're a lot prettier in the meetings. Like, they're all tan and clean, and, like, they brush their teeth. And I'm looking around. I'm like, I don't even like darts. I'm really bad at it. Like, I could hurt somebody. So maybe I'll just go. And I grabbed that fiancé person at the time and, you know, walked out with him. And what's interesting is my girlfriend called me a few days later, and she said that one of the guys that I had been with that had toasted a shot to my sobriety, he got in his car after the bar, and he died that night. He got in an automobile accident. And there was that moment, you know, if my sponsor didn't call, if things didn't happen differently. I mean, I got in cars with drunk people all the time. Like, that's God. That was that act of God. So I say that because I don't recommend going to bars when you go in the program. It doesn't really work that well. But I didn't do this program perfectly. I was a hot mess. Like, it was funny because I haven't been to YPG in a while, but I would come here, and this was, like, my night. And I'd go tanning before. I'd make sure that, you know, my boobs were up here. And my hair was all good. My makeup was on. Like, this was, like, my social hour. And so tonight I was getting ready, and I just kind of chuckled because I was like, what color cowboy boots am I going to wear tonight? Like, that was my biggest decision. So things do change. You know, stick around for a while. Eventually you learn how to dress yourself and how to be appropriate. Obviously, I'm still not good with caps, but it's, you know, it was my first year was, all of the consequences of my drinking just sort of happened in my first year. It wasn't fun. I didn't have that pink cloud. I saw all you with that pink cloud, and it's like, oh, that's awesome. I wish I had that. So I learned how to fake it, and And it was going through the steps was just such an amazing spiritual process, and it still continues just to be this evolution and this transformation and getting closer to God and learning who I am and how different ways to be of service and different ways to show up and how to love and how to love myself. And it's just been this amazing process. And it started with those steps. And every step got me closer to God and a deeper understanding and helped just all of those layers just kind of peel away. And it didn't happen overnight, and it wasn't this instantaneous thing that all of a sudden I was just, look at me, I'm great. But it's been this amazing, amazing journey. And you know, with my four staff, I really started to see just these different patterns and the way I was behaving and the different people I chose to associate with. And I was still living with, you know, this fiance guy, and I picked him because he was big and he was German and I thought he would keep me safe. And he was still actively drinking, and so he would come home late at night, and it wasn't a pretty scene. And so I did my four step, and I realized, like, this is not a good place for me to be in. And, you know, they say don't change where you live or relationships for a year. And something inside me just knew that I couldn't stay sober and be with him, because that's what we did. We went out and drank, and I was like his social director, and he didn't want to stop drinking. But I was too afraid to make that change. And so I came home one night, and there was a brown hair in my bathtub. I don't have brown hair. And so what I did is I put it in a little bag, like CSI, and I took it to a meeting. And I brought this baggie to a meeting, and I started showing the girls, and I was like, do you think this could be my hair? And like matching it up, and it had a really bad dye job. You could see if you held it up to the light. And they're like, you know what, Marilyn, I don't think there's any way possible that could be your hair. And I was like, well, I found it, you know, wrapped around, you know, in my bathtub, wrapped around my back scrubber. And they're like, well, you might want to think about that. And so I take my little baggie back home, and I'm just like, dude, you got 2 weeks. Like, just, this isn't working. And he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, what's this? So he tried blaming it on the dog, but at least, you know, I got him out. It was the dog. He must have brought it in from outside. I'm like, oh, okay. But I did it, and I got him out, and that was such a blessing, because I could focus on my sobriety and being of service and showing up and going to great fun things in sobriety and you know, like masquerade, dressing up in crazy clothing. And I drank a lot of Red Bull, and I was constantly shaking. And I did get fired in sobriety because I wanted to go to all the hangs and stay up late. And so I thought it was absolutely okay to sleep under my desk during my job, because it was for recovery. Like, I was tired because I was hanging out with sober people. So, but, I mean, that's what you were working with when I first came in. So thank goodness I didn't stay that way. and thank goodness that it's an evolution. And you didn't kick me out. You didn't say I was too weird or, you know, inappropriate. You love me through that. And we would rock out to Rascal Flats on the way to the beach. And it was a lot of fun. And I think of that time with such fondness and so many great memories. And I met my husband here, so he is absolutely just amazing and so caring and compassionate and supportive. I've had different life experiences in sobriety, and I got the opportunity to show up and to live and to be sober. And one of them was the passing of my mom. She was diagnosed with cancer, and when I was 2.5 years sober, she passed. And I remember getting the call and that she was going in hospice and just not knowing how I would survive. See, that was my if. That was my if. I could get fired in sobriety. I could break up in relationships. I could have all this horrible stuff. But when my mom, when she goes, that's when I'm drinking. That's it. Because I don't know how to handle that. She was, she was my best friend. She was my spiritual guide. She taught me how to meditate and taught me how I could use my breath and the moment to get closer to God and open just this huge spiritual world. And she was my protector for so many years. So her passing, I thought it would break me. But it was the people in these rooms, and it was a God of my understanding that allowed me to drive down there and to be with her, to be present for that, to lay next to her and hold her hand. And you all showed up. You drove 2.5 hours. I think there was something like 38 people that came and visited me within those and brought meetings to hospice. And I went to meetings there. And in fact, one woman that brought a meeting into hospice, my stepdad's now dating, so that's really weird. But we like her. She's in the program, and so is my stepdad, so that's good. But I did that sober. I was sober through that. And what an amazing gift. And I know that my mom is with me, and she's part of me. And I carry her around, and I'm absolutely her daughter. But I was able to walk through that. And you allowed me to cry on your shoulders and to experience grief. Not run away from it, but actually embrace it and look at it in the face and say, this is going to hurt, and it's going to hurt like hell, but I'm not afraid of this. I'm not afraid of this. And that, just an amazing experience to be able not to be afraid of death, that it's okay, that it can be absolutely sad and heartbreaking and scary, but not to be afraid of it. And then I've experienced such joys in sobriety, like getting married and having an AA wedding and seeing just all these spiritual guides and leaders just sitting out there when I'm exchanging vows. Like, I was jumping up and down at the altar because I was just so incredibly excited to be able to love. I thought I was broken. I thought I would never be able to have just this relationship that was founded in things like trust. I don't have to worry about what he's doing. I don't have to check his phone. I don't have to freak out if he's looking at another girl. It took me a while. I mean, I was a mess. I had my insecurities. But having that connection and being able to share this journey and invite God into our relationship. We meditate together and we watch quirky little documentaries about, Buddha and music and experience and explore. And that's absolutely amazing. I know that there was a time when I was so afraid to have kids, and I keep looking over at Annie because I hope you're not going into labor. But she's like, But it's beautiful having a child. That's the greatest gift we're ever going to get to do. And it's such a miracle. There was this time when I was so afraid to have kids because I knew I was going to hurt them. And I knew that I couldn't love them because I couldn't love myself. And now, Rob, I can't wait. But it's okay. I have, babies I can take pictures of now. So I'll hold off for a couple of years. But it's absolutely just amazing to get to that point where life doesn't seem so scary. So that scared little girl that was hiding behind the couch has found her wings and has found her voice and has found God and just something so amazing and so much bigger than myself. And I always heard in the rooms like, oh, God has provided me things that I would never in my wildest dreams would have imagined. And I would always nod and say, that must be great. What are you talking about? And this is like 5 years sober. And I had experienced great things. And I had found this amazing career and programs that could help me be of service in so many different ways. But I didn't really fully understand just letting go. Just absolutely just letting go. There were certain areas of my life I could. Like when my mom was passing, I had to let go of that. That was too much bigger than me. I couldn't control that. Or getting married, like all the planning and stuff and finances and budgets, I mean, I had to let go of that. But there was always something that I was holding on to and trying to make it Marilyn's way, right? Because it's a great way. But recently, I've let go. And my sponsor, Judy's here. And she says that these things to me that make a lot of sense and for some reason shifts the way I think. And I've been able to try different things without fear of what's going to happen tomorrow, without the sense of impending doom or I'm going to be screwed or whatever that is, and to really just say, what is next? For my prayers in sobriety were when I would wake up in the morning. Mornings were pretty traumatic. I would see just this day ahead of me. And I would pray for strength and for tolerance and for love and please God just help me be of service, which are all great things to pray about and wonderful. But it was almost like, please just make me get through this day. And recently, after just this shift, my prayers have changed. And it's been, what do you have in store for me today? How am I going to be of service? What crazy, quirky thing is going to happen? What challenge? You know, what is this great adventure of life? And how am I going to fumble my way through it? Half the time I don't know what I'm doing, and that's okay. And half the time I'm just giving it up to this higher power, to this God. And there's a sense of peace and serenity. And I would feel it on my cushion when I was meditating. But now it's almost like I can carry it around and tap into it. I still get really scared and financial fear. It's always kind of right here, but it's not driving my thoughts and it's not driving how I wake up in the morning. There's a sense of freedom there. It probably doesn't make any sense because it's not making sense to me. I've never really experienced this, but what I wanted to do is get up here and just speak with honesty and authenticity. And I don't know how this program works. I think it's because, I know it's because of God. I don't understand how God works. There's just this whole spiritual realm that I'm never going to understand, and I'm okay with that. But what I know is that what we have here together as a group is so, so incredibly special. It's absolutely amazing. We see lives just become transformed in front of our eyes and people receiving blessings and miracles. And I can be a part of that today. I can be a part of other people's lives and experience that. So I'm grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that. Lisa, I love you. It's sorry. I just saw her big shining smiley face, and I just love you. So, and that's one of the gifts. We get to have these amazing relationships in sobriety where we connect on a soul sister level. So, with that, I'm done.